Well, thank you for asking me to be here. So I think I'm going to continue in the line that was started by Michael and just sort of be talking more at the cross-cutting level about improving population health using a community health improvement navigator. Oh, yes, there's the no relationships to disclose. I work for the federal government, as you can imagine. I can't accept money from anybody. Just to give you a little bit of background about why we developed this navigator, it actually was motivated by the IRS rule, or the IRS piece of the Affordable Care Act that Michael referenced, the requirement for tax-exempt hospitals to do community health needs assessments and implementation strategies. And what people don't actually realize, the IRS actually came to CDC and asked for technical assistance when that was first passed. As you can imagine, IRS is not exactly a health agency. And they said, well, can you help us with this? And we thought it was a really great opportunity to try to align all these kinds of efforts. You've got the hospitals now trying to do community health needs assessments. You've got health departments trying to do accreditation of health departments. You've got United Ways or community-based organizations or community health centers. I mean, everybody's having to do needs assessments. And wouldn't it be better if they were all aligned and they actually worked together and they actually could have a greater impact? So we really wanted to support everybody moving together, moving collaboratively, and hopefully going further upstream in their work for longer and greater impact. So while this effort was very highly aligned with the IRS rule on community health needs assessments, I don't want to think of it as limited to that community benefit category over here, and especially as you see we're moving from volume to value in the healthcare system, we're hoping the hospitals understand, oh, this is how you're going to get to value by working collaboratively with others. The other thing, of course, that we all have probably noticed as the healthcare system is moving to population health, that they sometimes use different definitions for population health than we do. So I want to start with community health and defining it as an approach and the outcome of community health as community health and well-being, but also an approach. This is how you do it, right? It involves multiple disciplines and sectors. It engages and works with the community in a culturally sensitive way and uses public health sciences and evidence-based strategies. And this is adapted from a paper written by several of my colleagues at the CDC, and we made this indeed the second frequently asked question on the navigator itself, just to make sure people were aware this is how we are defining it. It's very much embodied by the way we approach the navigator. When we started to develop the navigator last summer, we spent a lot of time talking to people, to all the hospital associations, IHI, CHA, AHA, all these actually acronyms that I didn't even know before last summer, VHA, I didn't know some of these existed, AEH, some of which I did, of course, after my workforce experience, AAMC, AAHC. We also talked to our public health partners, NICHO, ASTO, NACHC, NASH, NASHP, all these acronyms, lots of acronyms too. What was it that would be useful for people? What is it especially that CDC could do to help in this area? And we ended up in our unifying framework and supportive tools with four main components of the navigator. One is brief case examples from health system partnerships with external partners, because what the hospital folks especially said to us is, we need examples to convince the C-suite. This is a little bit outside of our usual approach. We need to know that other peers have done this and we're successful hitting our bottom line in the current fee-for-service system. The infographic, which you'll see in the next slide, and I have available some hard copies of this, but is also downloadable from our site, is a storyline that sets the stage for collaborative work. I've been actually really surprised how popular this navigator infographic has been. It's been downloaded 150 times a week since we went live. So you will see it, and it's downloadable from our site. A focused set of tools to support effective collaborations. Again, I'll talk a little bit about how the approach we took to the tools, because there are lots of lists of tools out there in terms of how to do collaborative work. We took a very particular sort of curated approach to looking at tools, so we are not just adding yet another list of tools. And then the sine qua non, because this is coming from CDC, a database of evidence-based interventions to support movement to action. What people said, and you know, you hear throughout this meeting, I've been going to several sessions, how hard it is to partner, right? to work collaboratively, with, especially with multiple organizations that are not used to working together. You know, the whole forming, norming, storming, performing, it's exhausting to build trust. And what they said was, by the time you finish building trust, sometimes it's hard because they don't have enough energy left to find evidence-based interventions of things to do. And they said it would be very helpful if CDC would put stamps on things that had some evidence behind them. So this is our infographic, which I've been, as I said, really pleasantly surprised at how much people find this to be very helpful because of the fact that it's a simple message. You can see we use the word invest, especially to try to appeal to hospitals and CEO types. We had other words up here like health equity and things that everybody said, do not do that if you want it to appeal to the hospital system. So four considerations to improve health and well-being for all. Things that are very familiar to a public health audience, know what affects health, that it's more than healthcare, where, focus on areas of greatest need, you know, the whole your zip code can be more important than your genetic code. This is, of course, for them, sort of the 80-20 rule, you know, 20% of patients count for 80% of costs. You might want to focus on areas where you could have big impact. Who? Collaborate with others to maximize efforts. And we put a bunch of different examples of partners. The people are at the top of the circle because we're symbolizing that the community itself needs to be front and center and also brings assets to this work. We want a collective vision in the center. And then how? How do you get to it? Well, use a balanced portfolio of interventions for greatest impact. Don't just focus on clinical care, since we know that that has pretty small impact. And we are trying to sort of push them further upstream to couple some clinical interventions, perhaps, with interventions in these other areas of actions for longest impact. And, of course, it's not that these areas of activity are sort of mutually exclusive. They obviously interact with each other. This is what our landing page looks like. It's cdc.gov/CHINAV. And if you go to the top where it says CDC Community Health Improvement Navigator, that'll always bring you back to this home page. This picture here is actually of a rotating carousel that can help you with navigation among the site. We have this left bar here that's also a way to navigate to the various pieces of the site. The making the case, as I showed you, actually, I was going to page back up, never mind, I won't go backwards, is, as we said, briefcase examples for health system partnerships with external partners with outcomes that address their bottom line. It's actually surprisingly difficult to find these where somebody talked about it online. But what we wanted to do was have little teasers where we said this health system partnered with some external partners and then was able to hit their bottom line. And so we have little short little sentences, and then we give people links to other offsite. So this is what the landing page for the Making the Case for Collaborative CHI looks like. You can get to it whenever you click on this particular graphic. And if you scroll down here, this is not a live demo, although I could have tried a live demo, what you have is several examples, about 17 examples of hospitals partnering with community-based organizations, public health, et cetera, in either sort of comprehensive efforts to address asthma, cardiovascular disease, substance abuse, and a few examples even where the healthcare system went further upstream working on jobs or carbon footprint or educational scholarships. And as I said, the link then takes you to the story, which is in a Commonwealth Fund document or stakeholder health, et cetera, where you can get more information. As I mentioned, the tools, we actually did a curated list of tools, and we put them in the context of the action steps of a community health improvement process. You'll notice that this model here looks very familiar to the county health rankings and roadmaps, which we adapted. The only thing that we did differently is we really pulled out these four cross-cutting tenets. We wanted to really emphasize that these should be implemented throughout your action cycle. And then what we did was we looked for key concepts, looking at culture of health principles or the IOM report on primary care and public health integration or the report out of University of Kentucky about hospital partnerships with public health. And we looked for certain key concepts, and we looked at over 300 tools, and we said, are these tools practical? Are they helping to operationalize these key concepts? Do they have checklists? Do they have templates? And then we put those tools in certain places on this action cycle, not trying to be comprehensive, but more sort of focused. The other thing that we do have on our tools site is relevant excerpts from the IRS final rule on community health needs assessments for charitable hospitals, so as to emphasize that, yes, the IRS rule does say hospitals can collaborate with other hospitals in their community health needs assessments, or that they must engage the community, or they must consult with governmental public health. Here are some of the key concepts that we ended up highlighting, again, at strategic places around the action cycle, based on a review of various different sources. All of these things are described in our site. As a good scientist, I have a section about the navigator that sort of says, here's our methods, here's where we got our principles, here's where we decided on what databases to include, et cetera. And again, this is what the tools site looks like, and you've got the four cross-cutting tenets and the five steps of the action cycle. You can go directly to those. You can actually scroll down and also navigate from the visual for each of these steps. And then the database for selecting actions to implement, we put together this search engine. Sometimes I call it a kayak, although I'm not supposed to do that as a government employee because it sounds like I'm endorsing kayak. So it's a search engine for proven interventions that it can help move partnerships from planning to implementation and action. And we drew these from six different source databases that met our level defined criteria for level of evidence and accessibility. This is not to say that there aren't probably more databases out here, but this is where we started. And we searched for interventions that address specified risk factors associated with leading causes of illness and death. And what I mean by that is basically cardiovascular disease. But I didn't want to say that because when I talk to the healthcare system and I say cardiovascular disease, they think MIs. What we looked at is interventions that address tobacco, physical activity, nutrition, diet, hyperlipidemia, hypertension, diabetes, et cetera. And this audience would know that, but this is where we're starting to say high prevalence, high cost. This is where we started. And as we see that people find this database useful, we will add probably the first likely one that we keep getting a lot of feedback people would be interested in is, of course, mental health issues, behavioral health issues. What you can do on this database is filter the results by what target populations you like to address, target outcomes and indicators, intervention types or settings and locations and assets, whether physical or virtual or physical or virtual people and other organizational assets. What happens is when you're at the database of interventions, you can click on whatever target risk factors you like to address or target populations, target outcomes or indicators, and you can scroll down on the left. And as you check the risk factors you're interested in addressing, the results show up on the right side of the page. They are tagged for what area of action they are implemented in. They are obviously can be tagged for multiple. And let's say if we tagged here, social tobacco use and exposure, as you tag that, the results will start to show up on the right side from the various different databases. And if you're interested in getting more information about any one of these interventions, you can click on it. And then what will happen is you'll get a brief description of that particular intervention. And if you want even more information, you can click on the link below the title of the study or the intervention review, and you'll go directly to the original source. We have both individual studies, like from the AHRQ Healthcare Innovations Exchange or Healthy Communities Institute, and we have systematic reviews or synthesized evidence from the Community Guide, What Works for Health, etc. And then, of course, we did have a database of interventions glossary, as well as I mentioned, other information from about the navigator and about how we put it together, as well as additional tools and resources that didn't fall under the category of those that we specifically curated, but there were well-known resources like MAP and the Catholic Healthcare Association resources that people might want to know about. And that's it.
So, wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, thank you very much to all the presenters. Now it's your turn. Questions, comments? Yes, go ahead.
Dr. Hu, I'm just wondering, are you updating these regularly, looking for case studies, or is there a process to submit something?
That's a great question. We are trying to, we have it on here and on the site itself. We say, email us, give us feedback, and we check that site. The email box very regularly to see if people say, oh, you know, I'd like to include something, etc. As far as case studies, though, Certainly we're very interested in case studies that fall into the first category, making the case, they don't have to be, you know, rigorously evidence-based, but they're sort of more innovative, interesting. We're interested in knowing about those, especially where there's a URL or something described as, because this is about public access and information. As far as, so that's at one end of the spectrum. The other end of the spectrum on evidence-based intervention, we have a very close relationship with the databases that we use as our sources, and we are just going to continue with the relationship there because we don't plan to maintain it ourselves. So we're hoping that those things end up in those databases, and so that's sort of our meta approach.
So it's something more like a promising practice by AmChip. Does that sort of fall within your...
It might fall within the making a case example, especially, yeah. And that part is especially targeted at the hospital to say, hey, look, this is a good example.
Okay, good questions. I mean, this is a resource that, yeah, I think it really wanted to get the word out because it was so much. But I think that's a good question, how much you update it. I was also impressed that you built it on over looking at all the tools, over 300 tools and all that, yeah. Other questions? Yes. Can you just stand and just so you, we make sure we can hear you?
I think the IFS requirement are for the hospitals to submit the competency assessment and the implementation strategy. I don't see any requirement, you know, from the practice of the hospital, of some of the hospitals, that, you know, the CHI is a requirement. Like, you know, they publish CHI, they publish, you know, strategy, done, they met the requirement. After 3 years, another CHI and another, you know, whatever they see, that's should put under, you know, strategy, done, they publish. There is no coordination with, you know, with the rest of the community around the CHI. So I don't think we need, you know, to add requirements, you know, they are asking to add that, or can we do us, can we do something to move
this is exactly what motivated us to try to put together the Navigator, which is that there were a lot of hospitals that sort of check the box, right? That's what you're saying. You know, oh, I do home care for the underserved, check. I do graduate medical education, check. Those are two things that sort of fall into the category of community benefit. We really wanted to try to help them see that there are other things that they could do. Sometimes we're a little subtle with this, that actually, as you're preparing you in the hospital's healthcare system, we're preparing you into a value-based world where you are going to be responsible for outcomes. You have readmissions, you're trying to get reimbursed. You need to be partnering with others to actually do more, to go further upstream, because that will benefit you because of the fact that the ones who you're not going to get paid as much for, the 80-20 rule, the expensive patients, are the ones that they have real social determinants, and they need you, hospital A versus hospital B. You could all say something. That, of course, is not necessarily, you know, an easy, quick sell. But and back to your other CHNAs, yes, they are required to do those every 3 years. They are required to do implementation strategies. They are required to post with CHNAs, not necessarily required to post the implementation strategies. The final rule does require them, though, if they turn in their next round to evaluate their implementation strategies. Now, again, this is all in theory. But I have to say that I didn't have that much contact with these hospitals and healthcare systems before my summer, really. And it's been a very fast education for me at how many real partnerships there are out there. I think that it takes a while, we know, especially if they're moving in this area of doing more work upstream for us to see impact. But it's pretty genuine. Not everywhere. I feel like there's several categories of healthcare systems. There's the ones who just, oh, wait, I want this all to go away. And then there's the ones that are very sort of clearly at the front line, innovative, stakeholder health, you know, the Commonwealth Fund is always talking about that. We actually put a call out for a learning collaborative recently in regions 1, 2, and 3 of the country. We didn't give them very much time to apply. We said you had to have a health department, a hospital system, and at least one other sector as well. Within 9 days, we had 43 partnerships, and they were really impressive partnerships, applied. So it is out there. not everywhere, but I think that this has been a very useful impetus for collaborative work.
So in that sense, yours and Michael's work overlaps, because that was a question I was going to ask Michael. I mean, you kind of got into it, and I think your thesis is interesting. I'd love to debate that with you. But it's interesting that you pick states. Another way to say it, there are states where they haven't done public health services for a long time, clinical services. Yeah, and you didn't really pick one of those. So I think that this shows, you know, you didn't pick the Massachusetts, Minnesota's, or, you know, some of those.
Yeah, no, I think
it's just further elaboration.
I think even within those states, the jury is wider. The variation within states.
The variation is big, but the a direction. So, and we thought it was going to go away when we covered insurance, and it didn't. So did you look at talk to the state health departments as well as local?
Yeah, we focused more on the state health departments.
Okay.
We did meet with local health departments in each state.
Okay, cool.
And trying to get both the state and local.
Yeah. And I think your hypothesis about the rural and urban is interesting, and I just hope that it would be great. There is no study right now, or is NACHO doing this, to actually document whether the health department is working in an ACO or a community benefits kind of thing. I don't think anyone's systematically collecting it.
I think there's a lot of anecdotal stories. And I don't think there's much going on here.
Yeah, because that would be really good to just track that before and after. Does anyone else have questions? I was just for anybody, or you want to share your experiences? Because we were talking about kids, because some of you are from states that are covering them, some aren't. That would be great. Go ahead.
Me?
Yeah, you.
So I actually am not sharing that question. So with respect to the children who are still uninsured and not SHIP, and looking at the states that you listed in your presentation, the ones that were still a lot of them come out of immigrants, and there's a lot of undocumented immigrants. So could you talk a little bit about how CHIP, or I know under APA is not covered, so how that might work?
That's a great question. That is a great question.
I'll just editorialize for a second, and then Kathy can come in with an expert opinion. I think that when you look at those states, there are multiple factors going on. Some of them are philosophical and political. Some of them are exactly what you say, the population-based. So if you have a state with a high percentage of immigrants who are undocumented, that's going to be problematic. Can undocumented kids get into CHIP?
I don't think so.
Right.
Just emergency service, yeah.
Just emergency services. And I think the state can cover them on their own dollar for CHIP, but not with any federal funds.
That's right.
And with the ACA in the marketplaces, not at all.
Yeah.
No option for undocumented folks. So, you know, these are problems that are systemic. They're problems that are multifactorial. They're also problems that if we assume that the ACA is the solution to all of our problems, we're going to be disappointed. This is a weigh station on a journey that's been going on now for decades and which will continue to go on for decades when it comes to reform. When we think about reform at Catalan Center, we think about it in three categories. There's health insurance reform, which the ACA was primarily focused on. There's healthcare delivery reform, which the ACA has a lot to do with. And then there's payment reform. So value-based purchasing, value-based insurance design, those components. These are all things that we're continuing to work on in the system. And so even though we still have that 4.4 million kids who are uninsured, we've got to invent new ways to get them help. And if it's not in the ACA, well, that means we need something new. We need something to build on. So that's my editorial piece. Do you have?
Well, I was just going to say that we know from the CHIP experience that if you can enroll the parents, they're more likely to also enroll their kids. And so I think we saw that happen again with ACA and the Medicaid expansion, where even though theoretically all the kids are covered, even in non-expansion states, you saw greater take-up in the expansion states. There's just something about that doing it for everybody in the family that seems to bring people along.
This is a really, really good point. There's a very significant proportion of kids who are currently uninsured who are eligible for Medicaid, who are not eligible. And so the reasons for that, some of it is social determinants of health, some of it is education and awareness and health insurance literacy, and there are all kinds of different pieces that inform that. So if we don't necessarily need another big giant piece of federal legislation to do something about this. We need to streamline eligibility. It could be 24 month continuous eligibility. There are pathways to doing this, to getting kids into coverage, more aggressive outreach and enrollment. But I don't think that we've 100% utilized yet. There's still room for growth. Great question.
Yes. Go ahead. Yeah, sorry.
I said the same thing at the session last year, but with CHIP, there's about 300,000 pregnant women that are covered, and most of those women, if their unborn child who is covered, they are not eligible, mainly for documentation issues. So if we were to get rid of CHIP, we're taking prenatal care away from 300,000 women. And also, I was saying more about CHIP is the political theater we see at the federal level does not necessarily play out the same way at the state level. CHIP is very popular with many red states who have not expanded Medicaid, and they've done an excellent job enrolling kids. So I'm from the Marshall Islands Office of Government Affairs.
Great.
We did some grassroots advocacy where we got with helping governors to support CHIP, and it's very popular. It's a lot different than what's happening at the federal level, so I just wanted to.
That is a really good point. I think that if you look at those states, and I'm sorry, I don't know them off the top of my head, but if you look at those states who are getting 100% enhanced FMAP for their CHIP programs or close to it, a lot of them are red states. So they're getting a pretty good deal there. And that is popular with governors when they can get something paid for that they don't have to use state dollars for.
And some of those states have done really great things in terms of eligibility and enrollment simplification that other states that may often kind of come up to the top and be the more progressive ones can really learn from in terms of, like Meg was saying, there's kids that are eligible but not enrolled. Like, what can we do to just make this process simpler and less cumbersome and get kids in and keep them in rather than having them turn in and out? And so some of the southern states, some of the Medicaid non-expansion states have done really great eligibility and enrollment simplifications through their CHIP programs.
Right, because it's not called Obamacare, which is good. And that whole thing is 2 years away, which is interesting. So any other questions or comments? You guys have? Okay, well, go ahead.
Can you give other examples of other states that have something similar, like healthy San Francisco, where they're covering undocumented and undocumented?
Can I?
Yeah.
Is that the whole thing?
Well, the whole state of California now covers undocumented children. They have
You know, it's hard to know what the names were. In the old days, we had a lot of those, and we used to say in all the states, the programs were for those that were not covered by Medicaid. Yeah, you have to kind of mask it sometimes, too.
Well, San Francisco is for all.
Yeah, well, that helps.
Adults and children.
Yeah.
Is there anything else like that?
Yeah, Massachusetts covers.
Yeah.
Undocumented kids.
Oh, yeah, right.
I think.
And undocumented pregnant women since 1988. Mm-hmm. All pregnant women since 1988. Yeah.
Former
Massachusetts.
One thing that I would suggest is on the Gallup Center website, I'm sorry I didn't bring a link, we have a document around coverage and equity for children with special health care needs. When you look at the big population of kids with special health care needs and their insurance rate, it looks to be darn good, 96.4%. When you start to separate out subpopulations, so you start to look by race and ethnicity, you start to look by English is not the first language in the household, you start to look at age, the older a child gets, the less likely they are. When you start to look at gender, boys have more problems than girls, and you start to look at things like the educational level in the household of the parents, when you start to look at disability, you would think that a kid with a more significant functional disability would be more likely to have insurance than not, but that's not the case. So when you start to look at those subpopulations, you really start to see inequities. I don't say disparities, because disparities sound to me like differences.
Yeah,
and so that's
exactly
why I use those methods. We have a portfolio of work on our website that's starting to look at those inequity pieces. So we looked at the National Survey of Children with Special Health Care Needs, and we drilled down to these different subcategories and looked at their insurance coverage. We're developing a policy tool to help the health department, Title V specifically, address those inequities. We have a couple of fact sheets and policy briefs on inequities. So I think you might be able to find some of the data examples that you're looking for in those materials.
Okay.
That's not my portfolio, so I'll go off the top of my head as far as that. I think that we have to do that.
And, you know, even if it is there, it's harder and harder to get the word out on the street that ICE or someone else is not going to know. We have found it even much in really progressive communities, so it's harder. The community health centers are the biggest funder of services for undocumented.
Yeah.
If there's no program. That is the one last thing, and it has really expanded.
Yeah, it's not a, obviously community health centers aren't a coverage program, but they are a resource that does provide care to everyone.
Yeah.
They don't ask about documentation status. The Affordable Care Act did add a bunch of money for expansion of community health centers. It's not a solution, but it is a resource, I guess, that's available now.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay, well, I'd like to thank the panel. Thank you very much for excellent work.